Hunter Renfrow had a subpar first half, and that might actually be a kind way of putting it. I knew he was doing well post All-Star. I didn't realize how well, and I didn't realize that he had 23 home runs coming into tonight. We're recording on Wednesday, September 19th, in a shade under 400 plate appearances. Episode 175 of Flags Fly Forever, a baseball prospectus podcast. I'm your co-host, Mike Gianella, senior fantasy baseball writer at Baseball Prospectus. With me, also co-host, is Zach Steinhorn, fantasy editor at Baseball Prospectus. And behind the glass, as always, we have Jenmak Ramos, who is part of the Baseball Prospectus stats team. You can also find her work at the Hardball Times, as well as many other places on the interwebs. Zach, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well. Looking forward to what should be a very exciting finish to the season in NL Labor, where we're only a few points out of first place.
Yeah, so we've kind of put our eggs into that basket, because I think, Zach, you're, what are you, like fourth in Towers mixed or somewhere?
Yeah, something like that. Fourth, yeah, you know, fourth.
Yeah, I'm fifth in my tout wars, so really, and I have no chance of winning. So really, we put our eggs in the labor basket. I'm hoping we score a win there, which probably would have more to do at this point with Howard Bender of Fantasy Alarm, the wheels coming off, which have been happening the last couple of days, as opposed to us climbing. But we'll see what happens. We'll save that for a couple weeks, though. We'll have our recap show. Tonight we wanted to do two things. First, and I'll kind of tee this off, we wanted to look at some players who struggled in the first half and, you know, have bounced back in the second half. And I'd say for most of these players, they're deep league specials, or at the very least, they're players who have flown under the radar with their bounce backs. I'm going to toss it over to we're going over four of these guys. I'm going to toss it over to Zach for the first player.
Okay, so the first guy we're going to talk about is, I guess, a favorite of yours being a Mets fan, and that is Amed Rosario, who came into the big leagues last season with fairly high expectations. But up until around August of this season, he never really came anywhere close to meeting those expectations. And he entered August, he was batting .237 with four homers, 27 RBIs, 39 runs, and nine steals. Since the beginning of August, batting .291 with five homers, 22 RBIs, 33 runs, and 10 steals. And he added two more steals to his ledger tonight. He stole two more bases on Wednesday night. So that makes it 12 steals since the beginning of August. So are you buying into Rosario's recent surge? Or do you think this is a product of, you know, a developing young player who's taking the next step forward? Or do you just think it's a prolonged hot streak?
It's more of the fact that he's a young developing player who should get better. You know, my thing with Rosario and what I kind of look at and the one piece of this where I'd cool my jets a little bit. He doesn't walk, and 3% for this month. You know, if you look a month over month, the highest his highest walker he's been was 7% in June. That's what he is. Like he's someone who swings quite a bit. Which it's going to come down to with Rosario is the contact ability. I think because of his approach, no matter how well he looks at the plate, he's always going to have streaks where he hits 300 or close to it and gets on base and steals a bunch of bases. He's also going to have streaks where he hits 220 and you're frustrated and you want to throw things at the wall. So there should be a curve with Rosario where he gets better, but I don't think you're going to see – like what you're seeing in the second half isn't what you're going to see. I don't think you're going to see a 290 hitter with a lot of steals. The thing I do find encouraging, you know, first half, 11 attempts, six steals, you know, obviously that's a red flag for a speedster. Second half, 13 of 18, that's really what you want to see. You know, if Rosario can steal 30, 35 bases next year, you know, unless he hits that 220, which he won't, that's where the value is going to come.
Yep, that's exactly the point I was going to make. 18 stolen base attempts in the second half compared to 11 in the first half. So the Mets feeling, you know, comfortable letting him run, or maybe it's just a product of him feeling more comfortable on the bases. I know that I think Jose Reyes has been like tutoring him with base running. So I guess that's been effective of late. But yeah.
And he's 22 years old, and that's kind of an important point as well. I think when he came up, even before he came up and he was laying it up in Vegas, there was so much hype. And really, you know, he struggled. There's so many rookies like Ronald Acuna and Juan Soto who, you know, come up and light the world on fire, that it's easy to forget that for most of these players, there's an adjustment period.
Yeah, and he'll be only 23 on opening day 2019. So still very young, like you mentioned. But also, like you mentioned, you know, if he could get to the level of stealing 25 bases a year while hitting for a decent average and maybe even hitting, 12 to 15 homers at his peak, you know, that's a quality starting middle infielder, even in a 12-team mixed league. So that's probably the ceiling of what he could be. But that's still, you know, a valuable mixed league asset.
Yeah, I could see a little more power, like maybe 15 to 18, but I generally agree. And yeah, he's going to be playable because of those steals just about everywhere except maybe a 10-team mix. Rosario is someone who should work out.
Yep, I agree. And in keeper leagues, you know, he definitely has that added value just because he's still so young.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, in Dynasty, you definitely, you know, want to have a piece of him as well. Anything else on Rosario before we move on to the next player?
I think we can move on.
Okay. So the second player, this is someone kind of interesting because I have to admit I don't have him in any of my leagues. I was in on him last year, and it wasn't so much I didn't like him this year. It's that the price was a little high and prohibitive. And that's Hunter Renfroe. And the reason I mentioned I'm surprised, Hunter Renfroe had a subpar first half, and that might actually be a kind way of putting it. I knew he was doing well post All-Star. I didn't realize how well, and I didn't realize that he had 23 home runs coming into tonight. We're recording on Wednesday, September 19th, in a shade under 400 plate appearances. Zach, your thoughts on Hunter Renfroe? Because, you know, you put together this segment. Do you see him, you know, as somebody, you know, he's obviously older than Rosario. He'll be 27 on opening day next year. You know, he's entering or is in his prime. But do you see Renfroe as somebody who could grow off of this year and maybe hit, you know, 30, 35 home runs as a regular? Or do you see him as more of just a streaky hitter who's always going to have kind of these ups and downs?
I'm fairly optimistic about him. And, you know, I think it's easy to overlook the fact that he actually hit 26 homers last season in just 122 games. So that's, you know, prorate that, it's over 30 home runs over a full season. And, you know, the average was bad last year. He hit only 231 and the strikeout rate was high, but, you know, he's a former top prospect who came into the league with a lot of fanfare. And, you know, maybe he should have been given a little bit more respect in drafts, but like you said, his NFBC ADP among outfielders was 83. So I think that was pretty fair heading into the season. And I think that it might go up a little bit based on what he's done recently. 302 average with 9 homers and 27 RBIs in August. So I think he'll be maybe, you know, towards the back end of, like, say, the top 40 to 45 outfielders, which is fair. But I also think that leaves a lot of room for profit for owners, even in redraft leagues.
Yeah, I'd agree with all that. My thing with Renfroe is coming into 2017 and maybe even this year, it wasn't he was overhyped. It was more that analysts were looking at that ceiling and kind of saying, well, you know, he's somebody who could hit 35 to 40 home runs. You know, Petco makes that tough. I also do think the approach makes it tough, and Rosario Renfroe are similar in kind of that streakiness. They both have approaches that, and I've seen this with Renfroe, where he can go through a streak where he just looks like one of the greatest hitters, then go to another streak where he's just not making contact and missing everything. You know, I'm impressed because the TAV has jumped significantly this year, which again, I kind of like doing these reviews on players I haven't looked at closely and being surprised to be like, wow, I can't believe that Hunter Renfroe, you know, relative to his, you know, relative to what he's done, and I think some of his limited plate appearances has been, you know, really good. He has a 258 ISO, which, you know, looking at like qualifiers, like even in this era where there's so much more power and there's so many more home runs, that's a much higher number than I would have expected. And, you know, ISO isn't everything. It's limited in terms of its value and application. But it does tell me with Renfro that regardless of what else he does, like even if he's a 230, 240 hitter, that power is going to be there.
Yeah, and you wonder if playing half his games at Petco is really going to, you know, cap his power ceiling, which is possible. But then again, you know, you do worry about the batting average. He's never going to be really an asset in batting average, even though he's hitting over 300 since the beginning of August. But he also his strikeout rate has gone down a little bit this year, and his walk rate has gone up a little bit. So that's encouraging. He's someone that I think offers a little bit of upside heading into 2019, and that's why I think I'd be interested in owning him if I could get him, say, as my fourth or fifth outfielder in a 15-team mixed league. You know, I'd be very happy with that. Sort of like that post-hype sleeper concept that owners, you always kind of want to take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah, it sounds about right to me as well. I like pushing him into an OF3 in that format, it feels like a bit of a stretch, you know, partially for that reason is that power, while home runs are down this year compared to 2017's historic number, there's still a significant amount of dingers out there. So, yeah, I don't really feel like you need to push Renfro. I wouldn't pay for that 35 home run upside I mentioned, but if you're looking at 30 home runs, if you can live with the average, he's, you know, and realize, you know, he's not going to steal bases, he's a fine player to have. You know, one thing I'd add to your point is that, you know, in a mixed league with a deeper reserve, like a 12-team mix or a 15-team mix, you probably could try to play that Petco advantage. And one funny thing about that, though, he has about as many home runs this year at home as on the road. It's actually, you know, 12 compared to 11. So I always have this theory with players like Renfro that power kind of plays anywhere. And, you know, in 2017 was the same thing, 14 home runs at home versus 12 on the road. I just feel he's strong enough and kind of a like a bull or a beast that the power is going to play just about anywhere. You know, if you hit a ball a long way, it's going to go over the fence. Like, what, you know, Renfro is not a fence scraper. He's just a legitimate power source.
Yeah. And that certainly makes him more attractive. And I think the key with him is that you're not really gonna have to pay a whole lot to get him next year. So for that reason, I'm gonna probably own him in at least one league next year.
We should probably stop talking about him. Cause what I've noticed is, you know, we always think guys are going to go cheaply and, you know, it's October, or, you know, so not even October, it's September right now. You know, the more we talk about these players, the more they kind of, you know, build up helium. So let's use that helium as a segue. Yeah. So speaking of that, and I'll let you tee this guy off. The next guy on the list here was somebody who, I don't know about you, and I wasn't, but everybody was excited about him coming into 2018.
Yeah, Luis Castillo, and he's someone who I generally stayed away from just because I thought his price was, I think, a little bit too high considering that his big league track record basically spanned a half season. So I was a little bit wary of taking a chance on him this year. And as it turns out, I'm glad I avoided him just because he's been so inconsistent for pretty much the entire season. But as he's alternated good months with bad months but. He could, at the same time, he could be a nice buy low target for next season. So I always, you know, I'm a believer in these concepts of like the guy who's overrated the one year is underrated the next year. And I think that's the situation with Castillo heading into 2019. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I agree from the standpoint or the concept that, you know, so he has a 2.79 ERA in the second half. He's definitely looked a lot stronger. The home runs are not nearly as much of a problem. He allowed 19 home runs in the first half and a little over 100 innings. But still, he's allowed 9 of 50 innings, so the pace is about the same. My feeling about Castillo, what I've noticed, you know, watching other fantasy experts on Twitter talk, they kind of puff up their chest about Castillo, and they're constantly quoting, you know, what he's done in the second half or what he's done over his last 30 or 40 innings. That tells me there's people who are going to be in on him who don't feel burned by Castillo, who feel like the talent is so good and the stuff is so good that they're going to take the ride again. So the ADP should be down. I think he was, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was in the top 100 last year. I know he's pretty close to it. I could see him dropping a round or two, but there's going to be one person every league who wants to take the ride again, and the price will be fair. I haven't kind of like dove in or kicked the tires. I hate that expression, but there I am, to see if Castillo is going to, you know, kind of be priced that way. I guess what I'm saying is I don't see him dipping to say like 150 to 200 overall in ADP. I feel like people are still going to pay like 125, 130.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I think he was somewhere in that back end of the top 30 I'm heading into this season among starting pitchers. And I thought that was just a little bit too high. And I think I would say like maybe he would be towards like the back end of the top 50 this year. So at that kind of discount, I'd be interested. But like you said, he's, you know, even among like the industry, you know, industry gurus, he's someone that I think you know, his price is going to be still too high for my liking. There's going to be always someone in my league that's going to want him more than I will. And that's probably why I'm not going to land up with him.
Yeah. Something I don't like about the new NFBC, like in the past when it was housed on NFBC's actual site, you could actually differentiate by starters and relievers. Now it looks like it's just all, so Castillo was 30th overall, but that includes some of the relief pitchers. I don't know if that's what you meant to do, Zach. Like if you're not including the relievers, he actually went a little bit higher.
Yeah.
But that's the thing I'm trying to eyeball here, which is,
yeah, I was talking about just starters, but yeah, I mean, you could approximate that as what, maybe like 27 or something like
four, that. Well, let's see, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. He was 22nd among starters, and his overall ADP was 92. So yeah, he was like, to me with Castillo, that was my thing, is that I liked him and I thought he was great, like in terms of his ceiling. I just didn't like paying inside of the top 100 for a pitcher where I was like, yeah, you know, like Gerrit Cole, who's done it before, was a starting pitcher ahead of him. And my feeling is like, you know, I know Cole had a down year, but I'd rather go for the guy with the track record who, you know, has the ability and has done it more over half a season than Castillo. And that was a problem I had with Castillo. There were so many people. There was somebody I was talking to in the first half, like probably mid-May when Castillo was really struggling, where I said, you know, no offense, but like, how could you not see that like he could struggle? Not because he stinks, but because any pitcher could struggle. And this person responded, I won't mention who it was. He was like, no, I couldn't see it because Luis Castillo was that good. Like, to me, that's where people got stuck with Castillo. Any pitcher, especially any young pitcher, can struggle. There's maybe four or five pitchers in baseball who are in that automatic, like, you know, can do no wrong category.
Yeah, taking him at the 22nd pitcher coming off half a season, that's a little crazy to me. I guess maybe you could have done it with like what, Felix Hernandez coming off his rookie season or something like that. But you know, that's overly aggressive, and that's kind of a scenario where, you know, you leave yourself no room for profit whatsoever. The pressure is on him to deliver ace caliber numbers, and there's a high probability that it's just not gonna happen.
I you know what winds up happening is that, you know, you look at the pitchers around him. I mentioned Cole, and that's kind of a cheat. So, you know, we would have turned this into like the retrospective show if I wanted to do this, but the starters behind him were Ohtani, Tanaka, David Price, Jake Arrieta, Luke Weaver, and Kyle Hendricks. So I think what winds up happening, you're talking about a lot of guys that don't have the ceiling that Castillo did. So when you're looking at pitchers in that batch, I think that's when people are starting to say, hey, you know what? 23rd overall, Castillo's my number two in a 15-teamer with ace potential, you know, as opposed to an Arrieta or a Hendricks, where it's like, yeah, they could be good, but they're not going to strike, you know, they don't have the significant strikeout potential. I'm not going to have that ace ceiling. And I think that's what people are looking at. I'd like to think most people who drafted Castillo knew there was some bust in there and weren't just assuming that, you know, he could do no wrong.
Yeah, with me, it's all about the price, and for me that was just a little bit of a price to pay. I'm sort of like how you are. You know, I'm open to drafting, you know, any player usually if the price is right, but that was just that's an exception. That was crazy. So yeah. Let's move on to the other pitcher that we're going to talk about, and that is a much less much less of a big name than Castillo, and that's Matthew Boyd, who his situation is a little bit different compared to the other guys we talked about, just because he pitched very well both in April and May, but then ran into some trouble during June through August. And but over his first three starts in September, he has a 2.95 ERA and a 0.76 WHIP with 24 strikeouts and 18 and a third inning. So he's really finishing the season on a high note after a season where the majority of the season has been pretty productive. So where do you like rate him in the starting pitching field heading into 2019? Is he someone who interests you as a mixed league owner, or is he someone who you're just not too excited about?
I like Boyd in deeper mixed leagues. Boyd's a pitcher who, he's one of those slider. He didn't add the slider, but he went from, you know, using it occasionally to really relying on it. The usage jumped from about 11% in 2017 all the way up to 31%, which is, you know, a pretty radical jump. So, and essentially Boyd added in the slider, he got rid of the change. So he's pretty much a fastball slider pitcher. He will mix in the curve. I really like what I've seen at Boyd, and I think you could be looking at someone, you know, he's a little bit over a 4 right now. I could see him growing into someone with a 3.5, 3.6. I could also see Boyd taking another slight step forward with the strikeouts. I'm always a little wary of pitchers who rely heavily on the slider, because I feel there's a bit more either an injury risk or a fatigue risk. But yeah, overall, Matt Boyd is somebody I've got an eye on. And I think, unlike Castillo, you know, obviously he's somebody who could sneak in for the reason that, yes, he's done well, to your point, Zach, you know, of late. But I also feel like he's a pitcher that nobody is really looking at or is going to notice. They're going to look more at his overall numbers. They're going to look at the ERA over 4, the strikeout rate a bit under 1 per inning. You know, only the 9 wins, which, you know, I know that's mercurial and doesn't really tell you much about a pitcher, but no one's going to look at that stat line and think, I have to get Matt Boyd next year. So he's a good pitcher I'd kind of hope to sneak in a 15-team mix as like maybe an SP5.
Yeah, he doesn't have the name value of Castillo, and ERA right. of 4.08, which is so-so, but the 1.09 WHIP is very good. I was very surprised to actually see his WHIP that low. So that's a nice sign for – he's not that young. I think he's 27, if I remember correctly. So
He'll be 28 next year.
Yeah, so he's not, you know, he's not a, you know, young prospect or someone who you would think that would, you know, get so much better, but it has been, you know, encouraging to see him take this huge step forward at this
career. The one thing I'd add about Boyd with age and just in general with pitchers don't have the hitting curve is generally more linear, you know, where you're like, okay, if a hitter's 26, 27 is the peak or the beginning of the peak, and 32, 33 is when the fall off begins. You know, we've seen this with pitchers. You know, there's some pitchers that come up at 22 and they're lights out. But you can also see a pitcher like discover it all at like 29 or 30. I mean, heck, you know, look at Charlie Morton. You know, Charlie Morton kind of started coming into his own in his mid-30s or early to mid-30s. Other thing I'd point out about Boyd, I just want to give a hat tip. I think she listens to us sometimes to Emily Walden of The Athletic. You know, she covers the Tigers for The Athletic Detroit, also writes The Athletic MLB for prospects overall. She was all over Boyd and really was optimistic about him and had some good analysis coming into this year. And I did pick up Boyd in a couple of deeper mixed leagues as a reserve as a result, and that's been really helpful. So, yeah, Emily, if you're listening, thumbs up.
Yeah, I'll definitely be open to owning him. I actually, the more I looked at his stats, the more I was intrigued. Just today, I just looked at all these numbers. So yeah, he's someone that you know, like you said, he's not going to cost a lot because no one's really paying attention to him. But in a deep mixed league, you know, as one of those back end of the rotation innings eater type guys, you know, with WHIP upside, he's a fine option. So let's move on now to the other section of our show today, and that is going to be a look at the some top prospects who a few of them have already made their big league debut, a few of them have not made their big league debut yet, and the first one that we're going to talk about is not much of a surprise because everyone's going crazy about this guy, and of course it's Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who hasn't. Like, we all thought that maybe he would finally make his big league debut at some point in maybe in September, but it has not happened, even though he's dominated the minor leagues this year. 95 minor league games this season, a .381 average, 20 homers, 78 RBI, 67 runs scored, and he's only 19 years old. So how enthusiastic are you about Vlad Jr.?
I put this topic together. One of the reasons I did, so Justin Mason of FanGraphs and Friends of Fantasy Benefits is doing for the second year in a row early mocks. Are you part of this, Zach? Or were you invited, or is this something?
I'm not doing one. I think I was invited, but I just need a little bit of a break after the season's over.
No, I mean, on the same way, I'm doing some writing for the BP annual. I always feel that way. I always need to recharge in October, and you know, concentrating on mock and doing it well is kind of tough. But I bring that up because I didn't want to talk about Guerrero as a prospect. I think we all know how we feel about him. You know, he's going to be a superstar. And, you know, maybe it won't be next year when he's, you know, in the majors at some point as a 20-year-old rookie. But as we've seen with uber-talented players or like Acuna and Soto, yeah, he could be. He could be somebody who hits 35 to 40 home runs. And if he does that next year, you know, if he's up all year or most of the year, it won't surprise me. But what I kind of wanted to address is in this, you know, in these mocks, he has an average ADP, and this draft isn't even done yet. His average ADP is he's going 50th overall. And so if you're looking at a 15-team league, that is a fourth-round pick, and that's kind of in the earlier half of the fourth round. And that's what I wanted to ask you about. So last year with Acuna, I believe he was going in the sixth or seventh, maybe the eighth on average. I think he kind of climbed as the offseason went on. How do you feel about that for Vlad? Do you feel that's appropriate, or do you feel that's aggressive?
It's a little aggressive to me. I think Acuna last year was somewhere in the back end of the top 100, if I remember correctly, somewhere in that like 90 to 100 range, sixth, seventh round. So that seemed aggressive to me at the time. As it turned out, you know, owners who drafted him in that spot are going to get at least what they paid for him. But Guerrero, as much as the numbers are just, you could just drool over the numbers, 37 walks to 38 strikeouts as a 19-year-old in the minors. So, you know, as much as you know, you're excited about owning him even in a redraft league, spending a fourth round pick on a guy that hasn't even stepped foot on a big league, well, maybe as aside from being his, you know, the son of a Hall of Fame player, maybe he did step foot on a big league field, but not as a member of a big league team. But anyway, spending such a high pick on Guerrero, I think is just very risky. It's something that I wouldn't think about doing.
Yeah, I don't think I'd go that high either. Now keep in mind, this is nine leagues and it's an average pick. I believe the lowest, and you know, I'd have to look to see how far some of these leagues are, because these are slow drafts, and you know, I think we know how these go. Like some of them, you know, go pretty quickly. Some of them go very slowly. Yes, and it looks like two leagues haven't drafted him yet, which means that they're at probably an earlier phase. But his highest pick was in the second round at 23rd overall. And then which is obviously throwing off the curve a little bit. Right. But if you look at the seven leagues here, you know, 59th overall, 61st, 51st, 23rd, 75th, and 50th. So, yeah, he's going right around like 50, 51, you know, a little bit later in those other leagues. Obviously, 75 was a league where I think they felt more like you. Are you comfortable with Guerrero there?
In which round? You broke up.
End of the fifth.
End of the fifth. I'm still gonna be very hesitant to take it.
Yeah, you're conservative.
I can't do that. I just can't do that.
Which is funny because like I'm conservative and that's my reputation, and I've kind of been like, you know, like not badgered, but I've kind of been like needled for that a little bit. But yeah, I think even compared to me, you fall on the conservative side. I could see taking Guerrero at that slot, like kind of at that back end. But what I suspect is going to happen is I'm just not going to get him. It's going to be one of those situations. Like Acuna this year was a good example. I got Acuna for 16 in labor, as you know, because you know you've been running that team. I didn't expect to get him. That was pretty much as high as I was going to go. I thought somebody else would jump on him. And you know, it was just kind of a weird auction dynamic thing. You know, most auction leagues, he was going in like the low to mid 20s. in NL only, I was like, yeah, I'm not, I can't do that. That's just like too much.
Yeah, I was going to say that you did draft Acuña. That was a little bit out of character for you and the conservative.
Yeah, I mean, but I didn't get him anywhere else. And in drafts in particular, he was just like, you know, some of this with drafts, and, you know, just to kind of offer a comment on the early mock before we move on to the next topic, like something I've noticed, and I'm not going to say this to like criticize anybody, but what I think often happens that early pick of Vlad, for example, that's probably somebody trying to generate a discussion or trying to get their like name or their profile built up. And, you know, we know how that works. Like he certainly could, if everything broke right, he could be a second round player. You know, we know that because we've seen young players do that. You know, but what's really funny about Acuña, like I'm looking at the PFM right now, and I'm looking at where his value is. Acuña, as great as he's been, it's not like he's been like, if you took Acuña in the second round this year and you said, you know what, I don't care, I know he'll be down for like 7 to 10 days or however long he's kept down, I believe in him as a second round talent. In a 15 team mixed, you would have lost. Like you would have lost that bet. Like he's been solid, but like if I told you, for example, like if we look at these players around him, the hitters around, the three hitters ahead of him in a 15 team mix in the PFM are Gregory Polanco, Cody Bellinger, and Tim Anderson. The three hitters behind him are Anthony Rendon, Ender Inciarte, and because of the catching adjustment, Yadier Molina. That's really good. That's solid. That's something you want. That's not something that would have necessarily generated the kind of buzz that Acuña, you know, generated in the preseason.
Yeah, I've been trying to in recent years become a little more daring, and I have become a little more of a trader in recent years. But yeah, that these kind of examples of players who, you know, have little, if not none, if not a very little bit of a big league track record, you know, going in these like top 100 picks is just something I'm not going to participate in. So
the other side of that is what winds up happening. Players like Whit Merrifield, for example, who people want to like bash and be like, they're going to slip, they're not going to do as well. I would almost rather bet on the track record, even if it's a year of track record of a player who's done it before, than a player who hasn't. Like Vlad, as an example with Vlad, like I mentioned, like 30, 35 home runs. Like it seems to me that he'd have to do that and hit 300 or close to 300 to return that third or fourth round value, because we know he's not going to run. I don't know how much better the Jays are going to be next year, so I have a bit of a run RBI concern with him as well. So yeah, he, not questioning the talent, just kind of a matter of how I see him fitting in next year from a fantasy value perspective.
And like you mentioned, it's hard to really take these mock draft results seriously, just because, you know, like you said, there's a lot of owners who just want to generate that discussion. And it's probably more valuable to look at, you know, even like early NFBC slow drafts, or, you know, as the offseason goes on, the draft stats are going to be more beneficial for draft preparation purposes. So I'm not going to take it that seriously, but at the same time, you know, you get a little bit of an early sense of which players are probably going to be out of your reach in terms of what you're willing to pay for them.
Yeah, I think for players like Vlad and for Alberto Bondesi, it's interesting. You know, I do enjoy like kind of looking at it, but really it doesn't tell me much. And it often tells me that these are the kind of players I'm not going to get anyway. But what I find interesting about early draft, by the way, Acuña is in the PFM is 62nd overall in value. So that's the, like a beginning of the fifth round value. Really good. I think the way people are talking about Acuña, they're talking about it from a real life perspective. And the idea that, you know, for, in terms of his real life value and ceiling, he's special. But in terms of fantasy, he's been really good and he's returned a profit. He hasn't been the high end impact player that I think some people suspect he is. Let's move on, because I there were like three other players we wanted to talk about, and we spent a lot of time on Vlad. So who's next on my list?
The next guy we're going to touch on is Victor Robles, who I know he also has a lot of fans among the BP community. And after a 13-game stint with the Nats last season, he made his 2018 debut earlier this month. So far, he has one homer and one steal through 11 games, batting only .208. But this is really too small of a sample size to make any accurate assessments about Robles. But judging from his minor league track record, I'd say he's more of a batting average stolen base guy than a power guy. But, in this era of stolen base scarcity, it's a profile that carries up plenty of fantasy appeal, even in a redraft league for 2019. So how would you rate Robles, among outfielders in a redraft league, or what are your expectations for him for 2019?
He's a tough player to gauge because of the injury and the fact that he's missed time, and you're really betting on the steals and kind of hoping that the power comes along. All that being said, I like Robles a lot. And something I like about him with the Nationals, unlike some of these other players, the Nationals don't play service time games. They bring players up when they feel they're ready. I mean, we saw that with Soto this year. They could have just left Soto down, much longer in Harrisburg, and nobody would have blanked them. Like, all right, he's only 19. I know he looks great, but their brass were like, no, he's ready and he's going to play. So if Robles is ready, and right now he's not playing, I think because, I know the numbers aren't there, but he's not playing because of that injury. It was pretty serious. I don't think the Nats want to push him into full-time duty. They're also pretty stacked. What I would imagine happens is Bryce Harper goes somewhere else. The Cubs are the Bovada favorite as of today, and Robles gets a legitimate shot to start. I really like him. I kind of like him as an outfield too in a deeper mix, and a lot of that's because of the steals. I know there's some risk. I know he's young. I know he hasn't done in the majors yet. But at a minimum, that's the price you're going to have to pay if you want to like take Robles and hope for 35 to 40 steals.
Yeah, the key for Robles is fantasy value, as you mentioned, is the whole Bryce Harper situation. If Bryce Harper goes to another team, it's one thing. But if what if Bryce Harper settles for maybe a one-year contract with the Nationals to kind of re-enter free agency next season? I mean, that's probably unlikely, but it's a possibility. With the way the season's going for them.
I mean, it's a possibility. I the thing about that though is Harper has value beyond what he does on the field, and some of that's marketing. Some of that's his age. Like, he's definitely one of the faces of baseball. And honestly, the funny thing about Harper, his numbers are from a fantasy standpoint, particularly that batting average, are what's disappointing. But still getting on base at a 39% clip. TAV's down from last year, but it's certainly not way down. A lot of his warp and his value that looks like it's curtailed is because of defensive value, which I'm kind of cynical of, particularly on a one-year basis and particularly for an outfielder. I feel like Harper's gonna get paid, and I have a hard time seeing him, actually a qualifying offer. I have a hard time seeing him taking that qualifying offer to reestablish his value. The other piece of that too, this year, some of the reason that we saw teams scale back, and I'm not defending major league teams. If you see me speak about this on social media, I mean, if they're not openly colluding, they're at least suppressing wages. But some of that was you didn't have marquee players like Harper and Machado on the market. Some of it was a couple of teams wanted to reset their luxury tax. With that out of the picture, I feel like teams like the Cubs, the Dodgers, hard to see the Yankees as their outfield is pretty filled up, but Cubs, Dodgers, Phillies are going to be in on him, and somebody's going to pay him. I don't think Harper's coming back to the Nationals. I'd put the odds at like 5%.
Yeah, that's the most likely scenario, I'd say. I would just point out the tiny chance that maybe Harper comes back. But yeah, the most likely scenario is Harper goes on to another team and Robles enter spring training as the favorite to start in the outfield, and probably will start in the outfield to start the season. So I'm not sure if I'd draft him as like a number two outfielder in a 15-team mixed league. I would have to think about it. I have to look at the whole outfield field. But yeah, he certainly is an appealing, would be on my radar, in that area of the draft. Not sure if it's in that top 30 outfielder area.
Well, let me ask you this, because I'm looking again at this early mock. So I'm looking at outfielders now. Robles has only been drafted. These are guys only been drafted in a couple leagues, or like one league. So it's still early. But here's my question: just in this range, who would you rather have? Would you rather have Gregory Polanco or Victor Robles for next year?
Probably Victor Robles.
Robles or Nomar Mazara?
Mazara.
How about Robles or Andrew McCutchen?
Robles.
See, that's the funny thing to me about Robles, which is I get the reasons you'd be concerned about him. And another outfielder who's sitting above Polanco, Michael Brantley or Robles?
Oh, I'd probably go Brantley.
See, the funny thing about that, I think I take Robles over all these players because of how I value speed.
Right.
But, you know, McCutchen in particular, like, kind of surprises me to see him here, because you're talking about somebody who hasn't been elite or close to elite anywhere in a couple seasons now versus Robles, who, yeah, he could be a bust. He could hit 240. I feel like those steals are going to carry him to at least the value I see here, which is just outside of the top 180p.
Yeah, that's reasonable. That's totally reasonable. And it's a situation where, you know, I think about Robles and I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'd feel comfortable with him as my second outfielder. But then when you look at the outfield list, you're like, oh, you know what? There's really, you know, he's definitely in the top 30. You just don't see that there's, you know, when you look at other players ranked near him, oh, I'd still rather have Robles. So it's surprising, but, you know, that's how it, you know, that's how it goes, where you're just like looking at the list and you're like, oh, you know what? Maybe he's a little more appealing than I thought he was.
Yeah. So who's next on our? We have a couple more before we
So the next that I want to talk about is we'll go with Eloy Jimenez, who actually he's someone who I drafted in Tout Wars mixed auction in the reserve rounds, just hoping that he would get called up at some point, maybe in June. It never happened, and there was constant speculation that he was going to get called up this season. But even when it looked like it might happen, it just never happened, and the White Sox were very reluctant to add him to the big league roster, even though he was just dominating in the minor leagues. And let's see, 108 minor league games this season. He batted .337 with 22 homers and 75 RBI. So I think that he would make his big league debut maybe at some point in April, I guess. They'll probably play this whole service time game with him as well as the Cubs did with Chris Bryant and maybe the Blue Jays with Guerrero. So I'd say a mid-April debut, but what do you think about Jimenez?
I really like him. You know, he's not clearly not in the ceiling of Vlad. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he winds up having a better year next year or a comparable year, just because, you know, we know how it goes with rookies. But yeah, you're talking about a player with a great power profile, really good contact profile too. Something that jumps out at me, you know, 13% strikeout rate at AAA. I just feel like Jimenez is fairly polished for somebody his age. And he's a player who's going to hit. Like he's someone who, regardless of what that power looks like, he's going to hit 280, 290 at worst. And good park, in a position where there's nobody really in front of him. It's kind of rough to look at the White Sox and think, wow, I can't believe they, you know, kept Jimenez down all year. And we know why. You know, it was definitely because of the service time. You know, as a side thing, and this isn't fantasy related, and I've been harping on this all year, the White Sox attendance is down 24% from over the last 3 years. It's dropped 24%. You know, as much as you're talking about saving money on service time, and I get it, like I get that you're saving money, you do lose something at the gate when, you know, and with ticket sales, when you don't promote a player like this and fans are like, you know what, I'm just not going to come out. That's just a side note. That has nothing to do with fantasy. Yeah. But yeah, I think Jimenez is solid. He's somebody I'd like to draft. Interestingly, he hasn't gone in any of these early mocks yet, which I find kind of intriguing, because a couple of these, it looks like we're now down into the seventh round. Yeah, we're down the seventh round, I think, of the ones that are finished first. So that's kind of what people are looking at with Jimenez, which is they don't want to pay that early like freight like you're doing with Acuna last year, like people are doing with Guerrero and Robles.
And that's why I think, in a way, you know, Jimenez might be the more appealing option in redraft leagues than Guerrero, just because of the price. It's a scenario where, you know, I like both players, but maybe I'm going to wind up with Jimenez in a few leagues, just because, you know, people are kind of, even though they like Jimenez, they're just getting so obsessed with Guerrero that Jimenez is sliding under the radar just a bit. So I could see myself actually owning Jimenez, whereas Guerrero might be a little bit too pricey for me.
Yeah, I agree with that. If Jimenez is going like in the 10th or 11th round, I could see grabbing him and being like, you know what, I'd rather, you know, pay that like outfield three price for him and, you know, hope he's up, as opposed to, like you said, you know, paying that fifth round price for Vlad, where it's like, well, he might be a second round talent, but he also might be, you know, just kind of is what he is, and I could have taken a surer thing here.
Yep.
So who are we wrapping up with?
The last guy I'm going to talk about is the son of another former player, and that's Fernando Tatis Jr., who, like Vlad Jr., he's also going to be just 20 when next season begins. He underwent season-ending thumb surgery back in July, but he'll be ready for the start of 2019. I think that Vlad Jr. will get the call before Tatis Jr., and maybe it's – I don't know what you think, but maybe Tatis Jr. spends most of the season next year in the minors. We'll see. But I also think that, you know, his profile might be more fantasy-friendly than any of the other three players we talked about, just because of the overall production.
That's a really good point. You know, it could be Robles, because even if Robles only hits like 10 to 15 home runs, he has so much speed and you know, kind of offers that Starling Marte profile, which we see with Marte. Marte doesn't need to get over 20 home runs. You know, if he steals the way Marte can steal, you know, he's a second round talent. Yeah, but that being said, Tatis is, you know, he's like Vlad Jr., very advanced for his age. You know, great hit tool. There's supposed to be some growth in his size. You know, the one thing with Tatis, you know, the one caution is the swing and miss. You know, there's a lot of that. You know, I know he's only, you know, he's a teenager, you know, who was playing in Double A Cup of Coffee there in 2017, played there this year before the injury. That's a bit of a concern. I think it's something he can fix. But yeah, those steals are what jump out. I think what jumps out with Tatis is you can hope he keeps some or most or some of that speed, and you're looking at like a 30-15 or maybe optimistically a 30-20 guy.
Yeah, just as an across-the-board guy. I mean, maybe at his peak he's, you know, 25-25. You know, we'll see about that. But it'll be interesting to see if you know, how quickly the Padres call him up, how he performs in spring training, if he's going to spend the majority of the season in the minors, or if he's going to come up early. So that'll be just something to keep an eye on. And also another thing to note with the Padres is, you know, it's not like they have this all-star starting shortstop on their team. They have Freddy Galvis. So it's not like there's a, you know, a block. It's not as if he's blocked at a given position. So that's something that also bodes well for his shorter term fantasy value.
Yeah, I believe Galvis might be a free agent this winter. I'd have to look at his contract.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if he's got another year after this year, but he's also somebody who, you know, he made almost $7 million. Even if he's not a free agent, I could see, you know, the Padres non-tendering him and being like, yeah, we'll see you later. Unfortunately, I don't have that in front of me. I didn't expect to talk about Freddy Galvis. But yeah, to your point about Tatis Jr., wide open path. However, I do suspect you might be right. They could keep him down in part because of the injury and, you know, part because of the performance. The performance was solid, but unlike some of these players we've been talking about, it wasn't on the level where you're like, oh my gosh, like he needs to be up the day before yesterday. And again, the Padres, like the Nationals, they haven't really been playing the service time games. For the most part, they've been promoting the players, you know, when they're ready or when it looks like they should be promoted. But yeah, I could see Tatis up in July or August as opposed to like April or May. So if you are drafting, you know, we don't know right now and, you know, things could change. But if you're doing one of these early drafts, you probably have to take him much later than the players we've been talking about.
Yeah, and I'll be very curious to see where he goes, say, in those, you know, those NFBC draft champions leagues where you draft, you know, 50 rounds, 15 team mixed leagues where, you know, 750 players selected. So it'll be interesting to see where he goes in those drafts, because they are redraft leagues, but they're also huge roster leagues. So we'll find out how confident the owner pool is in really gauging how much playing time he's going to get, how many games he's going to play for the Padres next season, as opposed to just being stuck in the minors.
Yeah, that all makes sense. All right, well, I think that wraps it up for us. We were looking at about 40 minutes. I think we went over that by about 5 to 10. We'll take a short break, and we'll come right back to wrap it up. that wraps it up. Another episode of Flags Fly Forever. This is episode 175 of a Baseball Prospectus podcast. I am your co-host, Mike Gianella, along with Zach Steinhorn, and behind the glass, Jen Mock Ramos. We'll be back, I hope, in 2 weeks. So we'll have our season recap, which should be a little bit longer. Hopefully, Zach and I will have a happy story to tell about labor in the National League and not a sad one. But I suspect regardless of what happens in that league, that's going to be the crux of the podcast. We'll see you in a couple weeks, guys.
Thanks for listening.